From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Gaza conflict. Trying to evacuate Iraqi minorities trapped by militants. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa becoming deadlier, plus the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israel and Hamas have agreed to extend their temporary ceasefire for 5 days, allowing the two sides to continue negotiating in Egypt for a deal to end the conflict in Gaza. Shortly after the extension was announced, the Israeli military said it carried out airstrikes in Gaza in response to Palestinian rocket fire. The military said it targeted terrorist sites in Gaza. It said at least three rockets were fired into Israel shortly before the 72-hour ceasefire expired late Wednesday. There was no reported casualties in any of the latest violence. Negotiators have been meeting in Cairo in search of a lasting pact for an end to the month of fighting that's left more than 2,000 people dead. In other news, a small contingent of U.S. troops landed Wednesday on Mount Sinjar in northwestern Iraq. They're there to look at plans for helping evacuate thousands of civilian refugees trapped there by Islamist militants. The U.S. has been delivering food and water to refugees for days now. They've also carried out targeted strikes against the militants. On Wednesday, several hundred displaced Yazidis demonstrated in the northern Kurdish city of Houthak, calling for the world to help them leave Iraq. This young Yazidi girl said, "Our condition is very terrible. We've been trapped in the mountain for 7 days without water and food. We want to get out of Iraq and go to Europe." British Prime Minister David Cameron says an international plan is being developed to rescue the thousands of Yazidis, as well as other religious minorities who were trapped by the Islamic State fighters. Mr. Cameron rejected demands by some British lawmakers to intervene militarily in Iraq, but said Britain would play a role in the rescue plan.
Well, clearly there is an absolutely desperate situation in Iraq, particularly on this mountainside. I'm proud of the fact that British aeroplanes and British aid have been playing a role and will continue to play a role to help these people. But we need a plan to get these people off that mountain and get them to a place of safety. And I can confirm that detailed plans are now being put in place and are underway, and that Britain will play a role in delivering them.
And while Iraq deals with a militant insurgency, a mass polio immunization campaign is underway in the country. The campaign, which is spearheaded by the Ministry of Health with the support of the World Health Organization and the UN Children's Fund, aims to reach more than 4 million children under the age of 5 throughout the country. Lisa Schlein is following the story.
Iraq has been polio-free for nearly 14 years, but the country has lost this status since this crippling disease paralyzed two children in March. World Health Organization spokesman Paul Garwood tells VOA this has set alarm bells ringing.
With two cases of polio in Iraq that have been reported recently and a relatively high number of unvaccinated children due to the insecurity and the difficulties in accessing families and children, especially in conflict zones, Iraq has now become very vulnerable to a wider outbreak of this crippling and incurable disease.
This is not surprising. United Nations health officials say hundreds of thousands of children are being displaced because of the widespread violence in the country. They say the children and their families often live in overcrowded, unsanitary facilities, conditions that put them at great risk of contracting infectious diseases. The United Nations estimates nearly 1.2 million people have become internally displaced since the beginning of the year. In the past few days alone, the UN reports almost 200,000 people, nearly half of them children, have been forced to flee their homes. The number of displaced has increased dramatically since June, when the militant group calling itself the Islamic State accelerated its attacks against the government, seizing large swathes of territory in northern Iraq. WHO's Paul Garwood says aid workers would like to immunize all children against polio in the country, but he notes it is unlikely they will be able to do so in areas controlled by IS militants.
It's areas where health authorities and WHO and UNICEF have access to. which includes Dohuk, so the area where many people have been displaced to.
Some 700,000 people have taken refuge in Iraq's Kurdistan region. This number includes about 250,000 Iraqi children and 125,000 Syrian children. Dohuk Governorate now is home to about 400,000 displaced. Aid workers say they will not be able to immunize thousands of children from the minority Yazidi religious group who are among 30,000 people stranded in the barren, blisteringly hot Sinjar Mountain in northern Iraq. The group fled there after IS threatened to kill them if they did not convert to Islam. The UN agencies are concerned about their inability to reach all children. They note the risk of the polio virus spreading among children that are not immunized against the disease is great. It is believed that polio spread to Iraq from conflict-ridden Syria, where 36 children in this once polio-free country are paralyzed. Iraq is one of seven countries where WHO and UNICEF plan to conduct polio immunization campaigns. They aim to reach 25 million children in the region with these life-saving vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And still ahead on International Edition, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Experimental drugs used to fight the Ebola outbreak arrived Wednesday in Liberia as the effects of that deadly virus continue to spread. World Health Organization says 1,069 people have died and nearly 2,000 cases of Ebola have been reported. In just 2 days this week, there were 120 new confirmed cases and 56 fatalities. The U.S.-produced drug, not yet tested in humans, will be used to treat two doctors in Liberia. Meantime, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan on Wednesday reassured citizens of his government's commitment toward containing the spread of the Ebola virus, despite the country's recording its third death. Nigeria's Information Minister, Labaran Maku, spoke about the number of Ebola cases.
The number of people that have been traced is 198. Now, out of this number, 177 are in Lagos, and they are being traced. Some are in quarantine. Some are being monitored by health specialists. Their movements, being monitored, and they are under directive from the Minister of Health.
During an emergency meeting with state governors and health officials Wednesday, President Jonathan emphasized the need for all to unite in overcoming the disease. The World Health Organization classifies Kenya as a high-risk area for the deadly Ebola virus. No cases have been reported there, but the WHO says Kenya's role as a major transport hub makes the East African country more vulnerable to the disease. We get more now from Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi.
Speaking to reporters Wednesday, the WHO representative in Kenya, Dr. Custodia Mandelat, said her organization has classified Kenya as a level 2 risk infection area.
The Ebola outbreak, West Africa, is a serious public health event of international concern. Our quick risk analysis shows that Kenya is high risk of transmission. Therefore, our preparedness to avert the importation of the quickly contained circulation of the virus.
According to the WHO, Ebola has infected more than 1,800 people and taken the lives of more than 1,000 in four West African countries since March. Kenyan media report some travellers have raised concerns over poor screening of people at the country's entry points, especially at the airport. The disease entered Nigeria last month when a man who was falling sick with Ebola arrived on a plane in Lagos. Kenya's Health Secretary James Macharia says the government is moving to combat the disease.
The ministry has constituted a multi-agency Ebola task force, which has been meeting for 3 months now to assess the situation at local, country, regional, and global levels and advise the ministry on response activities.
Mandelaat of WHO has commended the efforts being made by Kenyan health officials and workers. So far, the country remains Ebola-free, although worry that the virus will find its way into the country is running high. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
United States considering sanctions on anyone who is interrupting efforts for peace in South Sudan, and in particular, anyone committing human rights abuses. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf spoke to reporters Wednesday, a day after a delegation from the U.N. Security Council met with South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar.
They warned Machar that the politically and ethnically motivated violence put South Sudan at a great risk of famine, joined other council members in expressing concern that Mr. Machar had failed to implement the previously agreed upon commitments. So obviously, we can't comment on potential future action or who that may include, but which would, of course, have to be agreed to by the whole Security Council. But we are considering sanctions options as appropriate to target those who are acting to impede the peaceful resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, including and in particular those responsible for human rights violations or abuses or violations of international humanitarian law in South Sudan. We are also considering what other steps we might take under our own executive order that the president signed on April 3rd that puts in place the architecture for further sanctions. We've already undertaken some, but further ones as well. So we're looking at both. We're actively engaged in both.
At least 10,000 people have been killed since fighting erupted in December between President Kiir's government forces and supporters of Riek Machar, his former deputy and longtime rival. The two men signed a ceasefire on May 9th and agreed to form an interim government by August 10th, but they missed that deadline as peace talks in Addis Ababa stalled. Diplomats said both sides had violated the truce while negotiations continued. The number of refugees fleeing the strife-torn Central African Republic for Cameroon has declined somewhat, but not because the CAR is returning to calm. Refugees and aid workers say fewer people are able to make the trip because of malnourishment and insecurity. Moki Edwin Kinsica has a report from Gado on the Cameroon border.
The refugees entering here in Gado from the troubled Central African Republic look tired, sick, and hungry. According to the UN Refugee Agency, the numbers crossing the border has dropped in recent weeks from 10,000 per week to about 8,000 now. Marie Anjaba, who fled her residence in the CAR town of Bawa a month ago, says their numbers are falling because many Central Africans have died. She says fewer people are coming now because many of them either die while trekking to Cameroon or are killed by Muslim Seleka rebels. Among the humanitarian agencies taking care of the refugees is Doctors Without Borders, known by its French initials, MSF. One of its medical staff, Gervais Marshall Mbonyi, says many of the refugees tell terrifying stories. He says some of them tell him they spent 2 months in the bush and all of their family members were killed. MSF's communications officer for Cameroon, Leticia Martin, says most of the refugees who are still coming are in critical need of medical attention.
The situation is quite worrying. Even though the number of people coming from CAR to Cameroon is decreasing a bit, actually their health status and their mental status is very worrying. What is more specific nowadays is that it's people who arrive after maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 months in the bush in CAR, hiding from the different groups that are attacking people.
Not all refugees tell stories of desperation. Joseph Akaji says he left the CAR because he has children, and after months of violence, the schools have not reopened. He says he has decided to settle in Cameroon because their future will be compromised if they do not go to school, even though violence has gone down in their country. Akagwe Emmanuel says he and other students are looking for ways to fund their education.
sur le projet.
He says they have projects like opening up poultry farms to raise money and fund their education, and adds that some of them are in desperate need of money. For now, the United Nations Children's Fund is providing them some food. Doctors Without Borders Martin says they also provide health care for the refugees, but that the needs of the refugee children keep increasing.
We have been doing 56,000 consultations. We are taking care of malnourished children, and it's like more than 92% of the refugee children that have been taken in charge are in the MSF structures.
The reduction in the number of refugees started after a deal signed last month between rival militias aimed at ending more than a year of religious conflict. The first Muslim prime minister in a Christian-dominated country, Mahamat Kamun, was appointed in the wake of meetings. However, the appointment has been rejected by the mainly Muslim rebel group Seleka. An estimated 20% of CAR inhabitants have fled their homes in the conflict, which began as Seleka rebels toppled the president in March 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Gado.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Russian aid convoy moving toward rebel-held eastern Ukraine stalled on Wednesday in Russian territory north of the Ukraine border city of Luhansk. Ukraine officials have issued conflicting statements about whether the convoy will be permitted to enter Ukrainian territory, where Ukraine troops are battling pro-Russia separatists for control of the border region. After reports of a deal allowing passage for the convoy, Ukraine's interior minister said it would not be allowed in. Adding to all of this, some confusion, there's been no definitive statement from Moscow about the convoy's destination. Russian government recently granted a 3-year residency permit to former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who is wanted in the United States on espionage charges for revealing key intelligence documents. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshnera looks at whether Snowden's actions can be considered treason.
As an intelligence contractor with the National Security Agency, Edward Snowden had access to thousands of secret documents. Last year, he started leaking to newspapers classified material dealing with the NSA's worldwide surveillance programs. He first fled to Hong Kong and then to Russia, where he was granted asylum for 1 year. Now, Russian authorities have extended his stay for 3 years, providing him with a residency permit. Stephen Vladek, an expert on national security law at American University, says he is not surprised by Russia's action.
Because he really is still very much a thorn in the side of the American intelligence community. And perhaps most importantly, what that means in practice is that Snowden now has a place to stay until after the end of the Obama administration, by which point the politics surrounding him and the potential that he might return to the United States could be very, very different.
Snowden's actions and Moscow's decision to grant him a residency permit have reignited a discussion as to whether or not Snowden is a traitor. Richard Betts is a national security expert at Columbia University.
In my personal view, he is a traitor because he violated his secrecy agreements, because no single individual should have the option to put his own conscience or decisions about what's proper above the law. And I believe he's done damage to what I consider to be reasonable intelligence collection activities of the U.S. government.
Stephen Vladek takes a different view.
I don't think there's any evidence that Snowden committed treason. You know, treason is a very specific crime defined by U.S. law as requiring the levying of war against the United States. Whatever we think of Snowden, he may very well be a criminal. I think there's no question he violated the Espionage Act. He may very well be a patriot. I think that's a moral judgment. The one thing that I think we all should agree on is he's not a traitor. Traitor is a very specific legal term, and there's just no evidence that it's applicable in this case.
Vladek says the Espionage Act was passed in 1917, just as the United States entered World War I. It dealt with what was known as classic spying, for example, an agent of a foreign nation spying on the U.S. The problem with the Espionage Act, says Vladek, is that it's too old.
And so the Espionage Act today takes three very different activities, classic spying, leaking, and whistleblowing, and treats them all the same in any case in which they involve the transmission of national security information to someone who's not authorized to receive it.
Vladek and other experts say the Espionage Act has been used sparingly. But in the last several years, they say it has reappeared as a weapon that the U.S. government has been using in trying to clamp down on leaks of classified information. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Panama Canal turns 100 this week, officially opened in 1914. 77-kilometer-long channel joins the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans at the Isthmus of Panama. Made the world a bit smaller, creating a shortcut for cargo ships that are plying their trade. But 100 years later, the canal is straining from demands of expanding global trade. And as Mel Arcega reports, it may also be facing some serious competition over the next 100 years.
Taking over 30 years to build, tens of thousands of workers, and more than 27 million kilograms of dynamite, it's considered one of the biggest engineering feats of the 20th century. University of Maryland professor Julie Green is author of the book, The Canal Builders.
The Panama Canal is one of those phenomenal moments in history, a terrific example of engineering and technological strength of the United States, and really the coming of age of the United States as a global power.
But the work exacted a heavy toll. By the time the first ship crossed the canal, nearly 26,000 workers had died, some from accidents, many from malaria. But it also changed international commerce forever, especially in the U.S., says George Washington University professor Noel Moore on Skype.
It's because it enabled, for the first time, oil from California and lumber from the Pacific Northwest, but it was really the Californian oil that was driving the boat.
Today, more than 4% of the world's commerce passes through the canal, some 14,000 ships per year. But the canal's locks are now too small for much of the world's container fleet and the largest oil tankers. Transportation expert Rodney McFadden says bigger ships can be more efficient and more profitable.
They carry more cargo for about the same amount of money per mile. They are much easier on the environment, and they increase trade.
A Hong Kong company is backing a $40 billion plan to dig an alternate route through Nicaragua. If successful, it could pose a serious challenge to the canal. But critics say the project is redundant and impractical, especially when the Panama Canal is in the midst of a $5 billion expansion. Once complete, the new locks will accommodate ships the length of the Empire State Building and as wide as three basketball courts. Autodesk, the New Hampshire-based company that created the software for the project, is thrilled. Not only has the expansion created over 250,000 jobs, once finished, it will create thousands more around the world, says Autodesk spokesman Paul Sullivan on Skype.
The ripple effect here is interesting because once this canal is completed and these ships are able to transit the canal, you're going to see a lot more cities around the world competing for improving their ports so they can support those larger ships.
Of the approximately 160 ports in the U.S., only about 15 can accommodate the larger supertankers that will pass through the expanded canal. By early 2016, experts say this grand canal will be able to handle 97% of the world's container ships, doubling the canal's capacity and ensuring that it remains a marvel of engineering 100 years from now. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
Former world number one professional golfer Tiger Woods removed himself from consideration for the Ryder Cup team late Wednesday with a clear message that he is not healthy enough to play. U.S. Ryder Cup captain Tom Watson had been waiting for word on Woods' condition. 14-time major tournament winner's best finish this year was a tie for 25th because of nagging back issues at the start of the year that led him to have surgery on March 31st. He missed two majors, including the Masters for the first time, and did not return for 3 months. Woods Wednesday's decision eliminates a distraction over the next 3 weeks before Watson announces his team captain picks for the September 26-28 Ryder Cup matches against Europe. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Marty Curcius, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On August 14, 1848, the U.S. territory of Oregon was organized by an act of Congress. On this day in 1880, Cologne Cathedral, one of the best-known architectural achievements in Germany, was completed. Its spires reached a height of 157 meters, at the time the tallest structure in the world. It took over 600 years to complete. In 1900, an international force of European, American, and Japanese troops broke a Chinese nationalist siege of Peking's diplomatic quarter, effectively ending what was called the Boxer Rebellion, an anti-Western uprising. In 1935, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. Social Security is a government-sponsored retirement supplement program.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 millions of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health.
Social Security has since expanded its coverage to benefit disabled people. In 1941, even before America's entry into World War II, President Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill issued a joint declaration known as the Atlantic Charter. It was a statement of policy outlining Allied goals for a post-Nazi Europe. On this day in 1945, President Harry Truman announced that Japan had agreed to Allied terms of surrender, thus ending World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The leaders of South Sudan and the armed opposition challenging their authority have again failed to live up to their pledge to form a transitional government and end the fighting that has badly split the East African nation. The United States, along with its Troika colleagues from Norway and the United Kingdom, condemns the continued foot-dragging over negotiating a political settlement. Deadlines keep passing, and innocent people keep dying. It is both an outrage and insult to the people of South Sudan. The South Sudanese government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and opposition agreed to a 60-day time frame in which to form a transitional government of national unity. That deadline passed August 10th. Regional leaders helped broker the agreement. But despite the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, mediation team's best efforts for more than 6 months, neither party engaged in peace talks seriously, nor committed to inclusive negotiations. Over 1 million people have been displaced by the fighting, and the nation faces the worst food security crisis in the world. Meanwhile, recent attacks in Mabon County have resulted in the deaths of at least 6 humanitarian workers. Innocent civilians may have been systematically murdered based on their ethnicity. These killings further undermine the enormous humanitarian response needed to support the millions of South Sudanese in desperate need of life-saving food assistance and living in constant fear of violence. This crisis was not caused by drought or flood. It is a man-made calamity created by conflict. Regional leaders have previously called for punitive measures if the parties fail to secure peace by the agreed deadline. IGAD and the African Union should take immediate, appropriate action to help bring that about. The United States stands with the people of South Sudan. As the crisis continues and the threat of famine grows, our government will provide an additional $180 million in food aid. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar must assume their responsibilities to prevent further needless suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.